Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. This week, two more residents of the Rehabilitation Center at Hollywood Hills died. They are the 9th and 10th deaths after the center lost electricity during Hurricane Irma. The temperature of the victims was as high as almost 110 degrees. Today, in Tallahassee, a panel of state lawmakers, emergency management officials, and healthcare regulators will meet discussing what happened and how nursing homes are required to prepare for storms in Florida. That now includes mandated backup generators, a requirement Governor Rick Scott put into place a week ago. Now, the governor has blamed the nursing home operator for not taking action sooner. His office this week released more than 100 pages of documents laying out the timeline leading to the tragedy after Irma. The nursing home's own timeline describes calling FPL, several calls to Governor Scott's cell phone, and an emergency operations hotline. Do you have someone in a nursing home here in South Florida? How do you watch over their care? How are you supposed to know what hurricane plans that nursing home or care facility has? And what should be done to better protect residents in nursing homes and other care facilities? And what about other vulnerable communities here in South Florida for storm preparation? 800-743-WLRN. Our phone number to join the conversation, 800-743-9576. You can also send us a tweet at WLRN is our handle on Twitter. This is where we begin this week's Florida Roundup. Rosemary O'Hara, editorial page editor for the South Florida Sun Sentinel, is back with us, as is Jim Defeaty, host of Facing South Florida on CBS4, and Rick Christie along with us as well. Once again, the editorial page editor at the Palm Beach Post. All three of you, welcome back to WLRN. Jim, let's begin with you with CBS. What's the latest that you've been able to learn on the investigation into what happened at the Rehabilitation Center at Hollywood Hills?
Well, obviously, as you pointed out, we've had the 9th and 10th death. This is probably not going to be the end of it. There's probably going to be at least two or three more deaths that may come out of this as a result. FTLE, you know, is set up a hotline to look into this, the Broward State Attorney's Office, the Hollywood Police Department. And my guess is that this is going to expand. It wouldn't surprise me if you start seeing more and more federal involvement. This may ultimately be a case that ends up in the U.S. Attorney's Office hands as well.
What's the federal case here that could go to the federal prosecutors, Jim?
Well, you've got obviously you've got issues related to federal money going into a facility in which was not properly maintained.
Medicaid money. Yeah, sure.
Exactly.
Right.
So you can easily make a nexus to the federal authorities on this. And, you know, this is, look, we're now in that phase where things are going into the court system. But let's also remember, we're still burying people
at the same time. Yeah, we're
still having funerals. Yeah, so we're in the early stages of this very, very clearly.
And a very tragic story. Rosemary, has the medical examiner ruled on causes of death yet?
Well, you know, I'm not sure I know the answer to that.
So they have not.
They have not yet. Right. But even the governor has jumped to conclusions with this, perhaps with some evidence that he may have that he's not sharing with us. What do you make of the governor's response this week, coming out as strongly as he did, pointing fingers directly at the operator and even the owner?
Well, in some ways, you got to understand it. You know, the governor's been out front in a big way from before the storm started, now to after the storm started, and looking now like he's really standing up for people in nursing homes. So that's an alleluia. This against a climate in Tallahassee, though, that has rolled back regulations of nursing homes. You know, the governor fired the ombudsman, who was one of the strongest champions for people in nursing homes. The Florida House Speaker, Richard Corcoran, has put together a committee to look at what do we need to do, you know, post-hurricane, including in nursing homes, to ensure that people are safe. Well, this is the same speaker, the same legislature that has said we don't like regulations. And so the governor, in ordering that all homes have backup generators to power air conditioners within 60 days, has suspended regulations and the need to get permits. Well, those permits have a purpose.
Right.
They're meant to make sure things are installed properly and safely, and so that when they turn the generator on, the place doesn't go up in fire. So I think for the governor, I hope a lesson is that regulations have their place, and both in keeping people safe and ensuring that structures are sound.
Rick Christie, legislative deja vu. Here we go again. 12 years later, the state legislature tackled this after Wilma.
Yeah, they did. After the tough hurricane seasons we had in 2004 and 2005, there was a movement to get some more regulation of nursing homes and make sure that they had power to run after in the aftermath or during or in the aftermath of a storm. The same way we did with gas stations to an extent, but the industry pushed back. Pushed back on it, and even a compromise bill was offered apparently, but that compromise bill would have had taxpayers kicking out about $57-60 million or something like that to help them with the generators. And given how stingy our legislature can be with these kind of things, that one didn't go through either.
Right.
So you're right. We're back in the same place, but you know what? Florida lawmakers. Usually get motivated by a tragedy, and this is absolutely, you know, a tragedy and one we think was unnecessary, to be honest with you. So they may actually get something done this time around, but I think the jury is still out on that.
Talking about the tragedy after Hurricane Irma at the Rehabilitation Center at Hollywood Hills, that story continues developing. The 9th and 10th victims this week died. Governor Scott came out strong, saying, quote, "No amount of finger pointing by the Hollywood Hills Rehabilitation Facility will hide the fact that this healthcare facility failed to do their basic duty to protect life." 800-743-9576. Tom Hudson along with Rosemary O'Hara, Jim DeFede, and Rick Christie. Let's join Jeffrey in Miami. Jeffrey, you're on the roundup. Go ahead.
I just wanted to be able to add to what was just recently said in regards to what the legislature did by gutting that bill. And it just wasn't the legislature who had the influential lobbyists, but it was also the governor who, as I understand, didn't want to have a stringent bill on the skilled nursing facilities because of the influence that was peddled against the people and for the industry.
Are you talking about Governor Bush after Wilmer?
No, Scott.
Governor Scott currently. Yeah. Governor Scott currently.
Yeah. Right.
Certainly, Jeffrey, thank you. Certainly, Rosemary, as you mentioned, the governor, since being sworn in 2011, has taken a very light touch when it comes to regulations about all kinds of things. And here we are talking about the governor coming down quickly with new regulations, waiving the permit process, for instance, for proper installation, and hearing some real concerns on the part of these nursing homes and assisted living facilities and others about, frankly, just the ability to meet this 60-day deadline to get a generator in place that can power the air conditioning for at least 4 days.
Right. The nursing home industry, by the way, is pushing back on that it resisted the reform effort after Wilma. I have a hard time swallowing
Rick,
that.
Rick, you're laughing there.
Yeah, and for me, it's like, well, if you didn't resist it, then why don't you all have generators that power air conditioners? And this is especially the for-profit nursing home industry. You know, they're paid to care for these folks. They should have maintained conditions that, you know, keep people safe.
Yeah. Jim, what did we learn from the release documents from the governor's office this week, these 150 documents about timelines and phone calls and emails sent back and forth?
What we learned is that the governor has a whole lot more explaining that he needs to do. The governor is taking action against the nursing home and pointing a finger at the nursing home and saying, you know, it's ultimately their responsibility. But the governor has some culpability here as well. He gave out a private cell phone number. I'm not sure what the purpose of giving out his private cell phone number was to these nursing home and medical officials across the state, emergency managers, if he wasn't going to actually respond to what was going on with them. You know, what? One of the things that the governor has said repeatedly is that at no time did anyone from the Hollywood Hills nursing home say that there was any patients in peril or in distress. Well, his own documents don't support that. Mm-hmm. In one of the documents, it talks about on September 12th, the Tuesday, the before the death started occurring, you had the Broward County Emergency Operations Center contacting the governor's emergency management office up there in Tallahassee, saying that the AC was out at the nursing home, power was out to the AC unit, and it was, and the exact words were, adversely affecting patients. Mm-hmm. That's a full 12 hours before all hell broke loose at that nursing home. So what was being done? Repeatedly, the governor's office says that the calls were returned to the nursing home. Well, when you actually look at the timeline, what you realize is any messages left by that nursing home on the governor's cell phone were returned 4, 5, 6,
right.
7 hours
right.
later.
And the governor's office says if there was a problem, why didn't the home call 911?
Well, there was a lot of numbers to call, apparently.
Right.
And this is one of the problems that you've got with the system, the way it was set up. You had the information line, you had the emergency line,
right.
you had the governor's cell phone,
yep.
you had 911. Look, the governor still has a lot of explaining to do, as does Florida Power and Light.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't spoken their name much in this time,
right.
and they need to have an understanding, too. And just a one last point about regulations. You talk about the priority lists that were created in each county. Look, it's easy to just dismiss this as a generator issue, and that's what the nursing home industry would like to do. This goes a lot further.
Yeah.
The priority list needs to be looked at. Who creates those lists? If the county is creating those lists with FP&L, then the county needs to be held more responsible. But why should the county be the one creating the list?
So these are the lists that are provided to the power company, FPL, about what are the priorities to get power back on when power is lost. And the priority one can be emergency operations centers, substations for additional electric distribution, those kinds of things.
Acute hospitals,
right. police stations, law enforcement, public safety, all of those kinds of things. A nursing home, this specific nursing home, was not on that number one priority list. It was on a number two priority list, which is higher than residents, but not as high as mandatory, kind of all hands on deck, let's go and do what needs to be done to get the power back on quickly, Rosemary.
Yes, I spent a good amount of time yesterday with the head of FPL, Eric Silagy, and asked him about this. He didn't want to go into real close specifics on the nursing home. I did note to him that it sounds like they called you a lot of times mm-hmm. and thought that you were just around the corner and were going to show up at any time. But he goes back to the issue of personal responsibility, that this place is paid to care for people, and they first needed to have a plan in place for when the power goes out, because hurricanes are not a surprise. His other point is that if you have Broward County, he told me, has 760 facilities on the critical tier one critical care critical response list. The whole Broward County list has over 10,000.
Mm.
So if you have 10,000 or two, you know, priorities, then you don't have any priorities.
Right.
He said mm-hmm. that I asked, is any nursing home in the state on a critical tier one critical list? He said no, but there were some critical care, some specialized kind of nursing homes that were.
Well, Rick Christie, we understood from the timeline that that when the facility called FPL, alerting them to the lack of power, and then there were additional calls made either to the governor's office or the state emergency hotline that allowed that ticket with FPL to get upgraded to some priority level. But yet there was still a delay in getting that power back for the home.
Yeah, and I think this goes beyond a simple the power was knocked out to the nursing home facility. I believe that a tree limb or something fell on a power line which was connected to the nursing home. So it was a different kind of situation than just restoring power. The FPL would actually have to go there and restore power outside.
Right.
And I guess for me with FPL on this is when they say that, oh, well, nobody really gave us these guys as to put at the top of the priority list. Well, you're a $1 billion company run by some pretty smart people. At some point, you have to be able to think for yourself that if you've got 90-something-year-olds who don't have air conditioning in a facility, that's not like a bunch of high school kids at a high school who don't have air conditioning. 90-year-olds cannot last. You know, you have to say to yourself, wow,
yeah.
maybe they won't be able to last as long.
And for what it's worth, the parent company of FPL, NextEra Energy, is a $69 billion company.
And
right.
Florida
Sorry.
Power and Light
Sorry.
Florida Power and Light made $1.7 billion yep. in profit last year. And my question is, okay, so you have so many priorities. Where does shopping malls and the shops at Bell Harbor and
sure.
Gulfstream fall in relation
sure.
to a nursing home with the most vulnerable patients? When does FPL answer that question?
Jim DeFede with CBS4, Rosemary O'Hara with the Sun Sentinel, Rick Christie with the Palm Beach Post. Let's get some phone calls in here. North Palm Beach, Richard, you are on the radio. Go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to point out, I think this is far more than just a storm-related issue, but while we're on it, it's not just nursing homes, but there's a lot of retirement communities, trailer home parks and so forth, that have many old people in them. But back to the nursing home issue, once an industry gets large enough, essentially they pretty much have the political power to do as they will and become untouchable. Case in point, my mother-in-law was recently in a nursing home, and presenting numerous items that they didn't take care of, they found it easier to simply sedate her to the point so it's easier to manipulate. Yeah. Eventually, she ended up in the ER from an overdose, which one of the nursing home nurses said that she thought she was being overdosed. Even Narcan couldn't take her out. The bottom line was, though, after trying to get some help with this, with legal matters, essentially there was nothing that anything could be done. The nursing homes have things in place that make them unreproachable.
Richard, how's your mother-in-law? Is she still with us?
No, she's not. As a result of this, they were able to get her back out of the coma, but she sustained so much damage as a result from the overdose that she, after a week of agony, passed away.
I'm sorry to hear that, Richard. Sorry for your loss and your family's loss. I want to squeeze in another call here. George in Coconut Creek. George, you're on the radio. Go ahead.
I just wanted to also, we focus a lot into the negative, but from somebody that actually rode the hurricane at a hospice with her mother, you also got to get credit. My mother happened to be in a hospice in Coconut Creek. We lost power on Saturday. I was there from Friday all the way to Monday night. It was uncomfortable, but it wasn't crazy hot. And when it goes down to it, you also have to point to the fact that what were the families trying to check on their family members. And I was surprised by, I can count with one hand how many people actually went to check on their family members on the day after the hurricane.
Yeah.
I happen to be the only one that actually stayed there for the duration.
George, did the facility with your mom have air conditioning and power?
No, they did have backup generators for life support.
For life support.
One of the things
that
once we lost power on Saturday, they advised the tenants, the residents, not to open the windows to keep the coolness. They made fans available. They kept them busy, and some of the staff, they were incredible. I mean, they get nothing but props from me. When somebody was there for 4 days, and I saw the same staff there for the duration.
George, great experience. It sounds like. Thank you for sharing it with us here on the Florida Roundup. Boca Raton is up next. Derek, you are on the radio. Go ahead, Derek.
Hi. I was thinking of this more of a political angle. I think with the governor being very pro what everything we want to hear, saying it's against that the operators messed up and that there are people to blame.
Right.
Is going to be just an easy way to score political points. But one of the hosts had earlier said that the point of regulation was to make sure that people are safe. So this was sort of hypocritical in her eyes. But since he is a conservative, a Republican, just because they didn't have he didn't have as much regulation in place as we would have liked to keep safe.
Right.
His philosophy is that it actually still is on whoever is operating it, just because.
Right. Gotcha, Derek. So Derek, the light regulatory touch of Governor Scott, you think here, and his very strong statements pointing blame to the nursing home is a win-win situation. Rick, what do you think of that?
Well, On the political point, and this kind of goes with I think something Rosemary was saying earlier about Scott and the hurricane. He was really riding a lot of kudos in his handling of the storm well before, during, and even after, before this tragedy. So it's going to be kind of interesting politically to see how this is handled and everything, because, again, he was doing really well. I think pretty much everybody was giving him high marks for the way he was handling things. But politically speaking, what may be helpful in terms of getting something passed through the legislature may be the fact that he may be running for the Senate next year. Does something may actually get done?
Rosemary, go ahead.
I'd just like to add that, yes, there were a lot of people in these homes that were helping these people, and it must have been heartbreaking to see what was happening. In a lot of places, a lot of people did great work during the storm. There are, now I just lost what I was going to say.
Oh, you go ahead and grab that here. We're talking about the people who stuck around in some of these places and did the kind of work that George was sharing with us with his mom.
And a lot of families did ask ahead of time,
right,
what is the plan,
yep,
at the home where mom is? But a lot of these folks don't have people to ask those questions,
right,
on their behalf.
Yeah.
And even if you are an inquisitive, informed person, trying to find information out about the quality of a nursing home is extraordinarily difficult.
Rosemary, I will say, for anyone who has personal experience with a parent or a loved one in a nursing home facility, even the best of nursing homes in the calmest of times, trying to get the information to be the best patient advocate you can without staring at a cone of uncertainty with a category 4 storm is difficult and challenging. Absolutely. One other point that I'll make in terms of the governor's response here, I think what we've seen from the governor during Matthew a year ago, and obviously what we've seen this year, Jim DeFede, is the governor being a chief executive. He has played that role, some will say, very well. Being a governor, in other words, actually governing, working with the legislature, that's a role that he's been challenged by over the past many sessions, wouldn't you say?
I think that's accurate. I think, you know, it's being a CEO. It's also being a candidate for the United States Senate in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
One point I did want to make just about the emergency plans that you talked about a second ago. Again, every home has to file an emergency plan. But who's reviewing that plan? They're sent to the individual's counties, and the counties check them for sufficiency under some standard that the state set. But Is the local county really the one who should go in and evaluate whether or not,
right,
the plan is adequate?
Yeah.
Is that not something either the Department of Health or the Agency for Healthcare Administration should be doing?
Yeah.
Where are the inspectors? Where are the follow-up visits?
Yep.
Where are the testing of these plans and looking at them with a critical eye? Where is the expertise? That's what was missing here. Now, I can give the governor full credit for being very present and being at every press conference during all these storms, but the real management of a state takes place in those little things that you do before the storm.
Yep. Let's go to Fort Lauderdale. Carolyn, you are on the radio. Thanks for holding on. Your thoughts.
Are you talking to me?
Yes, Carolyn. Hi. Thanks for holding on. What do you want to say?
Yes, thank you. I have a neighbor in my neighborhood, an elderly couple, and there was nothing I could do to expedite any kind of service for them while the power was out. They were under the same circumstances the rest of us, but obviously suffering more from lack of power. And they also, by the way, were very belligerent and refusing any help that I offered. But I tried calling. I tried to getting FPL to expedite things. I tried to get I called 911. They said, well, we could send a paramedic. I couldn't take that kind of responsibility.
Yeah.
And it just, there was no way I could get that the city would acknowledge. They said that the woman was lucid, but they never even met the man who was bedridden. And, they had fired their healthcare professional, mm-hmm, during all this. So, understandably, they were a problem, but still, I feel as though the city should have taken some responsibility for them.
Sounds like they're awfully lucky to have a neighbor like you, Carolyn.
Well, actually, all of us have a bit of a waning relationship with them because they have been so difficult.
Yeah.
But we do still
look
keep
out
an
for
eye
them.
Out.
You still look out for them, Carolyn in Fort Lauderdale. I think Carolyn's point there, while directed at maybe some elderly neighbors, really has the plight of vulnerable communities. And we've seen this on display, not just with the elderly, not just with senior citizens and living facilities or senior communities without power. We've seen it across the socioeconomic spectrum here in South Florida. In fact, this week at a Miami-Dade County Commission budget hearing, commissioners heard from people criticizing the county for not helping some neighborhoods get ready to deal with the aftermath of Irma, or for that matter, the preparation. This is Andrea Mercado. She's the executive director of the New Florida Majority.
As we went door to door, we found families who did not have the resources to evacuate, who did not have transit to get to shelters, who did not have money to prepare or purchase supplies. And in the days after the storm, families went hungry. Elders suffered from the heat. People with diabetes were desperately asking for ice for their insulin, and the level of need was reprehensible.
Valencia Gunder was also at the meeting on Tuesday in Miami-Dade. She told the commissioners that her group helped serve over 21,000 meals in 5 days after the storm.
It was disheartening to step into Liberty City on Tuesday morning and have a grown man cry and tell me he hadn't ate in 2 days.
WLRN's Nadej Green joins the Florida Roundup now. Nadej, you actually were with Ms. Gunder during some of those meal services. What was that like?
I checked in with them before the hurricane and then just after, and they were on the ground fairly quickly because she was part of a group that actually got together maybe 2 days before the hurricane hit, and they were like, we know we have poor people in our community. We know that there are people who are food insecure in our community. What are we doing so that in the 3 days that it might take for response or help to come, that these folks aren't going hungry? And the result of that meeting was kind of like, it might be too late to do that today, obviously, to get, you know, a list of names and addresses. But they did agree among themselves, number one, that they need to get together after to figure out a plan long term, but that they would do it themselves. And so they created a collective to do that.
The county commission listened to this during the public hearing this week, and individual commissioners pushed back against what they were hearing to say, did you go to my district? You weren't in my district. You're not talking about my district. And the mayor really was critical of some of these groups to USA Today, essentially telling Gannett he's never heard of any of these folks.
And that's unfortunate, because I don't think you need to know the name of your constituents to hear their concerns, or that you need to recognize their faces to hear their concerns. These are not fake Miami-Dade County residents who are showing up at a commission meeting pretending to have been there. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I can vouch for the fact that they fed people because we were out there when they were feeding people. Yeah. So I think that's a non-start to say that this didn't really happen. I think it's fine on the county to say, well, we did do things right. But if people are coming to you and saying, well, here's where we think you didn't do enough, that should not be dismissed.
Jim DeFede, how about this? Unprecedented evacuations throughout of South Florida, throughout the entire state, for that matter. The mayor of Miami-Dade County, Carlos Jimenez, pushed very hard in kind of the waning day or so to open up enough shelters for 100,000-person capacity. And now the criticism coming from some corners of the most vulnerable communities, the socioeconomic vulnerable communities, that not enough was done.
Well, it's not a huge news bulletin that the mayor of Miami-Dade County can get ruffled easily when you criticize him.
It's true.
Andrea Mercado from the New Florida Majority, she's actually going to be a guest on my show this Sunday morning at 8:30. And we talk about this because I've always said storms reveal two things. First, they point out the best and the worst in humanity. You always see the best come out and you see the worst come out during a storm. The second thing a storm does is it reveals in explicit terms the rift in the economics of our community, mm-hmm. the poor versus those who are less poor. And you know, you end up as a situation where I was without power for 4 or 5 days. I could go to a hotel. I checked in. I had air conditioning. I was fine.
Right.
Not everyone has that opportunity. And the fact that there were so many people out there who were wondering day to day on food, because you cannot store up food in advance if you don't have the money to store up food. The mayor says they could have gone to shelters. Well, the order for shelters was also you had to bring a 3 or 4 day supply of food with you.
Right.
You know, so these things become very complicated. You know, and part of it, and I'll blame the media too, Nadej being the rare exception. But the truth is that most of the media doesn't go into these communities to look for these stories. Instead, they go to Pinecrest. They go go to Coral Gables. You know, they go to the shops that are being looted, you know, in ritzier parts of town. You know, that's where we focus on. We don't go into the housing complexes, the public housing areas, and trying to understand how it affects them. Even if they didn't have storm surge, even if they didn't have a deluge of rain, it can affect their lives. If you're living paycheck to paycheck on the edge of society, this is the type of thing that will knock you off.
Rosemary O'Hara with the Sun Sentinel, you put together a thumbs up and thumbs down. What worked, what didn't work for this? Did you consider kind of this socioeconomic impact on folks that are living kind of, you know, paycheck to paycheck and their ability not only to have to stock up food, but perhaps maybe go a week or longer without work and without money coming in?
Well, you know, there is this tendency after the storm hits and people first say, I need ice for my insulin or my oxygen tank, to think to yourself, gee, why didn't you make a plan? You know, why didn't you have a plan in place? We all knew this was coming and they told us. But there are people who are unable to do that,
right,
to have help, to afford to do it. We heard about the shelters, and we gave kudos to those who, you know, got the shelters going. I guess the Red Cross. There were some hiccups in Miami-Dade. Nurses, though, and the school personnel, they all gave them a thumbs up. But I think the one question that we didn't ask hard enough is, once the storm has passed and it's safe to go home, how do people without power in low, especially who are struggling, how do we help feed them?
Right.
So we saw people like JetBlue serve 20,000 meals at BB&T Center, and Shabbat of Deerfield Beach was out serving meals to people who were shut in. But I didn't see some of the big charities organize. I wasn't aware of the big charities as organized in helping with relief efforts. And I really can't to this day tell you what is the county's role in helping organize move food and water to people after the storm.
Nadesh, how about that?
Here's the thing in our communities, which I think we do a horrible job at, is that we know poor people live among us. We know people live at or below the poverty line, or even if you're just the working poor or lower middle class, this is an issue.
Right.
We know this is an issue because every summer when school is out, we give out free meals to all of these students who we know will go hungry if not for the fact that we gave out free meals. Why did we not have that conversation, knowing that there may be a 1 week gap before you can go back to school? So even that vulnerable population, children who we know rely on public schools to eat, we were not talking about pre-storm.
Rick Christie, this is not the first go-around for South Florida in a major storm, but yet, like the nursing home situation, this also rings a little bit of a deja vu. Like, here we are again. Maybe we're 12 years after Wilma, 25 years after Andrew. Are these kind of half-generational lessons that we need to take away? And where does it go from here?
Well, I think again the local officials have to step up here a bit. Local government officials have to step up here a little bit. One of the things that I began noticing a few days ago, in terms of power restoration, as FPL was restoring more and more power to people, where we starting to get more and more emails and phone calls from people saying, "Well, they say my power is restored when I go to their website, but I can't get power in my home." And I think one of the things, particularly in lower income communities, and so one of the things I think needs to be done is that there needs to be some kind of program, if one doesn't exist already, to check the electrical systems of some of this, particularly public housing, because people were saying they were getting 110 instead of 220, I believe that's watts or something.
Volts.
In their
technically
home.
Volts. Volts.
Okay,
yeah.
Volts.
Yep.
I'm sorry.
That's
in their home,
right.
Which means you can't run your AC at 220,
right.
You know, or 110, I'm sorry.
Right.
And so while FPL was looking good in terms of restoring power and things of that nature, there was something people in some of these, in many of the lower income communities in these homes that have not been maintained that well, were not able to actually use that power.
We're going to leave that topic with Nadege Green right now. Thank you for the reporting on that, Nadege, and for joining us on the Roundup today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You are listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Tom Hudson along with Rosemary O'Hara with the Sun Sentinel, Rick Christie with the Palm Beach Post, and Jim DeFede with CBS4 along with us. The phone number, 800-743-9576. Let's talk about power restoration. The power is back on in South Florida. Thousands of crews, most of them from out of state, hooked up power again to millions of us over the past week and a half. Some lost power for a handful of days. Others, it was more than a week in the dark. Coral Gables has fined FPL for not getting power back faster, and a customer lawsuit seeks to become a class action case against the power company for the delays. Now, FPL spent $3 billion of customers' money after Hurricane Wilma 12 years ago hardening its electric grid. 10 years ago, the company agreed to trim trees around distribution lines every 3 years and every 6 years around lateral power lines serving fewer people. And now comes the assessment and the cost of all of this restoration. FPL customers are still paying a monthly recovery fee because of Hurricane Matthew. J.R. Kelly is the public counsel of Florida. He represents utility customers before state and federal regulators.
About the time that the Matthew surcharge will come off the bill, I would anticipate a new surcharge being placed there for Irma.
So just how much? We don't know yet. So as we wait for that, it's the first weekend in 2 weeks that you may have power. So congratulations. What was the first thing you did when the electricity came back on? Andrew from Fort Lauderdale told us power in my Coral Ridge street was restored at 8:15 Wednesday night after more than 10 days. He says he and his wife hugged with tears in our eyes and rushed to turn on the AC and then took a long, hot shower. Stefan in Fort Lauderdale, I was at a friend's house about 3 blocks away. His power came back, and the three of us who were there stopped whatever we were talking about, and we all instantaneously started hooting and hollering in celebration. We had a cold beer out of his cooler to celebrate, and the first thing I did when I got home, stand under the AC vent for about 5 minutes straight.
My name is Chad. I'm from Hollywood. The first thing that I did when my power came back on is run around the house and laugh and smile. I couldn't believe that that short amount of time I appreciated electricity so much.
This is Reese Williams from Delray Beach. When the power came on, the first thing I did was to turn the generator off and thank God. I also said a thank you to FPL for getting it done in a day and a little more.
This is Robert in Pembroke Pines, and when my power came on, the first thing I did was take a nice air-conditioned nap.
AC and hot showers. We wanted to be cool and clean is what we wanted to be after being without power. 800-743-WLRN. Let us know what you did when the power came back on if you happened to lose it because of Hurricane Irma. Jim DeFede with CBS4, the host of Facing South Florida, is along with us from his studios. Rick Christie, is the editorial page editor at the Palm Beach Post, with us from Boynton Beach. And Rosemary O'Hara, the editorial page editor for the South Florida Sun Sentinel, with us in studio. Rosemary, you mentioned earlier you spoke with FPL management and the president, the CEO, Eric Szilagyi. How did he assess how his crews and those crews that they rented from out of state did?
I think that he's proud of the job they did in getting 99.7% of homes on the East Coast restored by Sunday evening, the deadline, or the goal that he had set. I think he takes great umbrage at those who think that Republican neighborhoods or rich neighborhoods were restored first, and points to Coral Gables as, if that's true, how about Coral Gables? Or even in your wonderful recap just there, Coral Ridge. Mm-hmm. And I think he recognizes finally, that the communications was a real problem, that they need to do something about that and give people better information about when it's going to be restored. He says this was a tree event, and he was unable to get the number of crews. They have a vegetation crew and a line crew. And they needed one for every one, and he was unable to get the number of vegetation crews he needed. But he also complained that, certain cities have been resistant to trimming, certain neighbors don't want the trees trimmed, and as some of the crews have gone in, they've got 500 bee stings, and somebody ran over a guy in the cones, mm-hmm. and so they've been up against a lot. The crew, everybody, the line people who've worked so hard to get us back, hallelujah, and thank God for them. But there are lessons.
Jim DeFede.
Any chance you were able to find out from how much he's going to be able to sap from us in terms of a rate increase to pay for all of this?
Well, it'd be a recovery fee.
Goodwill?
Technically, Jim, a recovery fee is the way that the Public Service Commission would determine
yeah, we're,
that.
We're, what I liked was, for instance, we're paying the recovery fee on Hurricane Matthew, yet still don't have a truly itemized understanding of what that $315 million went.
That is correct. But,
you know, and now we're going to probably get hit with any idea how much, Rosemary? Did he have a number yet?
No, he's, you know, was focused on getting the power back on first. He would note that they expect, because of the size of the storm, that they're going to expect or, you know, go for federal relief, on this. And that the good credit rating they have means the money they'll borrow to pay these people up front and pay for all this up front to get reimbursed later is something that'll help save. But, you know, no, he's not. And it's going to be billions of dollars. But he did make the point, too, that this isn't a rebuilding effort, which is what he had said in anticipation of a storm that was so big.
The expectation that FPL put out there, Rick Christie, in the days before the storm, when that cone, when that track took it right through Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach buzzsawing up, was this may not be a restoration effort. This may be a rebuilding effort. Turned out it's a restoration effort.
Right, and so the cost to not just to them, but obviously to us, and whatever recovery fee we'll have to be paying, will be less. But so I think as Rosemary is saying, probably the more valuable thing we get out of this is the lessons that these guys learn from dealing with the storm.
Well, it's one of those lessons, though. You know, FPL, and we've done stories here on WLR, and all four of our media organizations have done stories about the hardening, the investment, the
right.
new concrete poles, the polymer couplers that are supposed to wave in the wind better than they did during Hurricane Wilma. But now some of that communication is those are designed for better restoration, not to withstand and stay in power necessarily.
Well, right, but looking at their numbers, it actually worked better. Mm-hmm. I mean, after Wilma, remember people were out for weeks.
Yeah.
You know, after Wilma, I think, and the majority of people, and now the majority was reduced down to 1 week for most people.
Rick, let me squeeze in just a call. We got Bob from Southwest Ranches who says he was a retired lineman. Bob, you've been hanging on. Thank you. Retired lineman. Were you with FPL?
Yeah, for a short time. I was an inside wireman with the Dade County local, and then
gotcha.
So I went with FPL.
All right, you weren't in the bucket
but
trucks.
But here's the deal: real simple solution to this. They did it in Weston. There's no overhead power in Weston. Put everything underground. Take some of these billions of dollars that they're making profit and put everything underground. I know they can do it. They can even do it with primary because I did it for them on Kendall Drive from the Turnpike extension to US-1. It would be real simple, and guess what? All the trees could.
Bob, I want Rosemary to address it because I'm sure she spoke with FPL's CEO about this. It's a common refrain. Let's put the power.
I heard what they said about it. He says, you can put all the stuff in the neighborhoods underground, then up the primary. The problem is he's avoiding the truth. You can't put primary underground. They just don't want to do it. And if you take all the money that they're spending from the subcontractors to come in here, and all these surcharges, and all this money that they're taking from us, they should have had this crap underground a long time ago. The entire city of Weston is underground.
So what you're saying, Bob, is the main distribution lines can't go underground. Is that what you're saying?
It can. Everything can.
Everything can. Rosemary?
Not the big transmission lines that go across the state. That's
sure.
Story.
Sure. What
that is, wasn't, that's not a problem.
Gotcha. But underground brings together its own set of challenges. Flooding, water, high water table, eminent domain, property rights, all those other things. What did FPL have to say about
this?
Thing.
All of their new couplers are waterproof.
Gotcha. Bob, hold on. I know, Rosemary, you spoke with Eric about this.
I sure did. He makes the point that everything can be undergrounded depending on how much money we want to pay. And the cost of putting everything underground is just through the roof. The power starts above ground, then goes underground, and then when it comes back up to your house, it comes back up under. It comes back up. So there are places along the way that even if the lines to your house are underground, yeah. getting it to the place where it starts to go underground is above ground. And, you know, the cost of doing that is so great. A tree can fall on that green transmitter pad thing that's, you know, outside your neighborhood, and that can put it out. Water can come up into the lines. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I guess I pushed back on him, though, that they'll say, well, you know, if there's flooding, neighborhoods do better in wind if it's a wet storm, and if it's a windstorm, underground does better. He said the acreage in Palm Beach County has overhead lines, which that surprised me, but they and that they stayed in power. So, but that flooding is a difficult problem because we don't know exactly where the problem is, and then we got to dig it all up. Well, what about this smart grid? You're telling me that the smart grid doesn't tell you exactly where the problem is? It does tell them where the problem is.
Jim DeFita, yes. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to, though I am to turn the conversation away from FP&L, I didn't want to let this go by also talking about AT&T and Comcast and the cable companies.
Sure.
And while it may seem like a first world problem, you know, by and large, you know, I can't watch Sunday Night Football and that sort of thing, it's also an economic issue.
Sure.
There are a lot of people who do home businesses. There are a lot of businesses that need the internet to be able to operate. And I think that while a lot of attention rightfully is focused on FP&L, I think a lot more attention needs to be on AT&T and Comcast, whose service is proven very, very bad during this situation. And the thing that angers me the most, I'll give FPL credit, at least FPL documented how many outages they had by county. They talked about how many crews they had pre-positioned, how many crews were in. I have tried for a week to get that information from Comcast and AT&T. They refused to break outages by county.
Yeah,
they refused to say how many people they have pre-positioned or they brought in from out of state.
Yeah, we spoke with Verizon Wireless just days after the storm, and they were touting that 96% of its towers in Florida were back on. They could not give any more local information, nor would they share with us how many of those towers were on temporary power versus how many of them were on shore mainline power. So I agree, Jim, the lack of information that we're seeing from our telephonic or ISPs, internet service providers here, and others has been woefully low, certainly compared to the information that we had from the electricity provider that we've got here in South Florida. We do want to move to the Caribbean here because Hurricane Maria, Category 3 storm, the eye near Turks and Caicos, as we're live here on the Friday, it made a direct impact on Puerto Rico, knocking out the island's electric grid, millions facing the prospects of week without power there, maybe even longer. Maria took a similar path in the Eastern Caribbean less than 2 weeks after Irma, hitting the U.S. Virgin Islands, for instance. Rear Admiral Peter Brown leads the U.S. Coast Guard's 7th District, headquartered here in Miami. That's the sound of Maria there making the landfall in Puerto Rico yesterday. Rear Admiral Brown has had assets in place in the Caribbean near Puerto Rico ready to deploy.
St. Thomas took it worse than St. Croix from Hurricane Irma. St. Croix took it worse than St. Thomas from Hurricane Maria. And, of course, the island of St. John also took a blow. You combine that, all three of the major U.S. Virgin Islands were terribly impacted, and recovery will take some time.
All three of you are veteran South Florida journalists. Jim DeFita, do you recall any time where these powerful of storms have come one right after another, essentially in the same track, at least in the Eastern Caribbean?
I think I remember that famous Miami Herald picture of the four hurricanes. I can't remember which four it was, back to back to back. But you're right. This has been a horrible time for the Caribbean and for so many of these other islands. And just what's going on right now with the most recent Hurricane Maria on Puerto Rico, while our hearts and sympathies go out to them, we also need to understand here in Florida, this could have a major impact on the state of Florida.
Right.
Because if you're out of power in Puerto Rico for 4 to 6 months, I guarantee you there are going to be a lot of people who are going to be moving from Puerto Rico to Florida in the days, weeks, and months ahead.
Yeah, and that Puerto Rico certainly is a territory, but Rosemary, it may be any one of those islands that we can see an influx of immigrants or refugees for that matter.
Right. The islands are, Puerto Rico was already struggling from damage from Hurricane Irma. It's in a terrible economic crisis and has not been able to make investments in infrastructure. Its electrical grid was already weakened and not of the level that we expect from our service provider here. It's described as a Katrina-like event for Puerto Rico. And so I think Jim's right. People are not going to live without power for 6 months. And given the families and connections here in Florida and elsewhere, I do think that we're going to see more people move here.
Rick Christie.
Well, I'm kind of I was kind of curious to see here what the president is going to say when he visits Puerto Rico, because I'm sure that that issue is going to come up while he's there,
right,
surveying on the ground what's the impact of the storm. And so I'm kind of curious to hear what he's going to say, given his stance on immigration.
Not only that, but it's going to, you got to think it certainly reignites in a more significant way the statehood debate, and obviously how Puerto Rico is going to have to, how it deals with this, what is it, $70 billion in debt, and if there's some kind of debt forgiveness legislation that Congress is going to try to pass as part of an emergency response to the disaster.
I can't imagine this Congress passing a debt forgiveness bill for Puerto Rico. They've refused to do so all along. And, you know, they want, it's about, it goes back to that personal responsibility, work hard. The unemployment rate in Puerto Rico is something like 27% before the storm. So it's like, do you really want to make those that have invested pay the price for the island's lack of ability to get its economics right? It's a tough problem.
She is Rosemary O'Hara with the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Rick Christie has been along with us from Boynton Beach. He is the editorial page editor at the Palm Beach Post. And Jim Defeatty with the studios at CBS4. Jim, you will be on the television on Sunday for Facing South Florida. Thanks to all three of you for joining us on the roundup this week. Appreciate it, guys.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Finally, a bright spot for South Florida baseball fans, at least. Now, the Marlins are not going to be in the playoffs, probably, and it's long odds that the team will even finish over 500. But there is Giancarlo Stanton.
Breaking ball. Homered again.
Number 56 Wednesday night, that call from Fox Sports Florida. The Marlins have just 10 games left. Stanton needs five more to match Roger Maris's 61, that pre-steroid era record. Just five more. That'll do it for the Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Bridget O'Brien. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontato, our digital director. Terrence Shepard, our news director. Alicia Zuckerman, editorial director. Technical supervisor, Jason Zabka. Thanks for calling. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson. Have a great weekend.